Be English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Israelis have once again taken to the streets to protest against the judicial coup, as they call it, proposed by Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's extremist right cabinet. Iran and Iraq kick off construction of a major railway project connecting the two neighboring countries. And people rally in the Serbian capital Belgrade to demand action against corruption among politicians and violence in society. Hello, everyone, and thanks for tuning in to World News. Now, tens of thousands of Israelis are back on the streets of Tel Aviv for a 35th consecutive week to protest against what they're calling a judicial coup.
I came out here today with my family so that we can protest against the judicial coup. It's a crucial time right now. We need to come out. We need to be in the streets. We have a big vote in about 2 weeks, and I can't tell you that I'm hopeful, but we are not going to stop coming out until we're able to turn back and make sure that everyone has someone else watching over what they're doing. Nobody has the power to make changes at their whim.
Now, mass protests against the so-called judicial overhaul have been ongoing since it was proposed by Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's extreme far-right cabinet back in January. In August, Israel's Supreme Court began hearing the first of a series of appeals linked to the overhaul, which set off unprecedented domestic crisis. Israel is now facing public unrest, labor strikes, and mutiny by some members of its military. The opposition believes cabinet is aimed at weakening the judiciary and preventing it from being able to maintain checks on the cabinet. They say protests will continue until they are able to repeal the legislation. Israeli troops have violently clashed with Eritrean refugees using live fire and stun grenades against demonstrators who are protesting against the government in the East African nation. Some 160 people were injured, some critically. Many were arrested. Violence broke out around an event organized by the Eritrean embassy to mark Revolution Day, which commemorates the start of the Eritrean War of Independence against Ethiopia in 1961. President Isaias Afwerki has ruled since Eritrea gained independence in 1993. Human rights groups have condemned his government as highly repressive. Eritreans make up a majority of more than 30,000 African asylum seekers in Israel. The regime in Tel Aviv has been under fire by rights groups for racism and discrimination against non-whites. Joining us now from Washington, D.C. is Mr. Netfa Freeman, a coordinating committee member at Black Alliance for Peace. Hello, Mr. Netfa Freeman. Always a pleasure to check in with you, sir. Hope you're safe and doing well out there in the U.S. Capitol. Now, Mr. Freeman, we often hear about this hierarchy. I mean, Israel considers itself a Jewish nation state, meaning Jews come first. But when you speak to the Jews that reside in occupied territories, you often hear that there's a hierarchy where the most rights basically go to the European Jews, followed by the semi-Jews, the Jews of Arab descent, Arab Jews they refer to themselves as. And then comes the Eritrean and Ethiopian African Jews. Your thoughts on this hierarchy and the fact that they're all Jews, but there seems to be different rights and different levels of entitlement when it comes to being a Jew in occupied territories.
I think the problem starts with the fact that we're dealing with settler colonialism, and every settler colonial system is predicated on an aspect of racism. It's fundamental to it, racism against the indigenous people. I was saying that the issue is predicated on the fact that we're dealing with settler colonialism, the system of settler colonialism where land is taken away from an indigenous people, and all settler colonial states are predicated on a racism against, and these are European settlers, and Israel's really no different than that. It's modeled after U.S. settler colonialism. Both Israel and settler colonialism, South Africa under apartheid South Africa, are modeled after the United States. And the complexity becomes when things advance and racism is no longer, is frowned upon globally, then they have to fend it, protect it as, or defend it as something else, you know. In Israel, the complexity is that Israel Zionism promotes something that conflates ethnicity, race, and nationality and nationhood. So as a settler colony, it also gives the sanctity of a Jewish people that's also predicated on religion as well. And so this makes it even more complex, but at the same time, there has to be this caste system for settler colonialism and for the justification of the theft and the sustenance of settler colonialism and Zionism in this case.
Thank you, sir. Always a pleasure to check in on you. Stay safe, Mr. Netford Freeman. Always nice to hear from you. Joining us from Washington, D.C., that was Mr. Netford Freeman, coordinating committee member of Black Alliance for Peace there, joining us. Meanwhile, Iran and Iraq have inaugurated the construction of a major railroad as part of a growing partnership between Tehran and Baghdad. The Shalamcheh-Basra connection project will link major port city of Basra in the south of Iraq to Iran's vast railway network through the Shalamcheh border crossing. It's believed the project will take between 18 to 24 months. It's been under discussion for years before finally an agreement was struck on it back in 2021. Now it's being inaugurated by Iran's first vice president, Mohammad Mukhber, and the Iraqi premier, Mohammad Shia al-Sudani. Mukhber says project will be completed over the next 2 years. Iran and Iraq are political and economic partners and determined to enhance trade ties. The Mujahideen-e-Khalq terrorist organization reportedly plans to move some of its members to Germany out of fears they may be put on trial in Albania, where the group is now based. Iranian media reports say a terror group previously planned to relocate members to Canada, but that plan hit a snag, and now it was choosing Germany. This is Albania, put various restrictions on the group's activities, including setting up checkpoints outside the MEK camp, cutting off their landline internet connection, and barring leader Mariam Rajavi from reentering the country. These follow an unprecedented raid by Albanian police on the camp in June, which was part of a probe into its terror and cyber activities against foreign countries and even Albania itself. And now the group fears that its members may be arrested and put on trial. Albanian Prime Minister Edi Rama said the MEK must leave the country if it wants to use Albanian soil to launch attacks against Iran. Iranians are marking National Day of Fight Against British Colonialism, commemorating the 109th anniversary of the martyrdom of Rais Ali Delvari, a great national hero and independence fighter who led an anti-colonial struggle in southern Iran. However, this year the occasion is even more special, as many Iranians have had the chance to mark this day where he's been laid to rest. Yusuf Misha Ahmadi has your story.
Remembering a national hero, a symbol of resistance. Many Iranians this year are marking the National Day Against British Colonialism at the resting place of a man who organized a popular resistance movement against British troops that had invaded Iran in 1915. Rais Ali Delvari's martyrdom anniversary has fallen just days before Arbaeen, allowing pilgrims who are taking part in the Arbaeen walk to mark the occasion at his resting place in Wadi As-Salam Cemetery in the Iraqi city of Najaf, where the pilgrimage begins.
Rais Ali Delvari was a hero just like Martyr Qasem Soleimani in our days. Actually, as Iranians, I think we're lucky that we had quite a number of these freedom fighters. For example, the Jangad movement of Gilan and the Tangistanis who formed the main resisting power against the British Empire in southern Iran.
We know that he was a young man living in the city of Delvar in Bushehr province, and he successfully fought against the British invaders. That is why we have to keep his memory alive and educate our young generation about him.
Martyr Rais Ali Delvari played an important role in the fight against colonialism. As Iranians, we owe him our independence and freedom.
Rais Ali Dilvari was born in 1261 in Dilvar in Bushehr. After the sudden entrance of British forces into the southern province in 1915, he led the Iranian army in their fight against British colonialists. Rais Ali Dilvari was ultimately killed by Anglo-Indian forces following months of bloody clashes. Today, his home has been turned into a museum and registered as a national heritage in Iran. And to commemorate him, his martyrdom anniversary, which usually falls on the 3rd of September, is marked on the Iranian calendar as a national day of fight against British colonialism. Decades after his martyrdom, Rais Ali Dilvari is still an inspiration, not just for Iranians, but for freedom fighters worldwide. Gisum Shahmadi, Wadi As-Salam Cemetery, Najaf.
Now, fresh details have emerged from a major Israeli sabotage attempt against Iran's defense industry that was thwarted by the country's intelligence. Military officials say a professional team led by the Mossad was trying to equip missile connectors with explosive circuits, which could be programmed to detonate at any time.
It's a plot out of a Hollywood movie, but with serious repercussions. The shadow war between Israel and Iran. This one involves an Israeli plot to sabotage Iran's defense industry, including missiles, the biggest military sabotage attempt against Iran in the past 100 years. It is one that failed, however, just in the nick of time. The agency's statement reveals the scope of the operation. The intelligence unit of the defense ministry thwarted one of the largest sabotage plots targeting Iran's missile, aviation and aerospace military industry. This sabotage was carried out under the guidance of the Zionist intelligence services and their agents. A network of agents sought to introduce defective parts into the production of advanced missiles, specifically defective connectors from abroad. The defective parts were discovered by the Defense Ministry Information Protection. The plan was to equip these connectors with explosive circuits. If that was done successfully, the connectors could be programmed to explode remotely at any time. But how was this plot unfoiled?
خودش حساس میشه به اینکه چرا مثلا اون طرف خارجی و اونایی که دارن بهشون این قطعاتو میفروشن این میاد مثلا داخل توزیع میکنه چرا حساس شدن حتی اینها بررسی میکردن توی بازار خرید داخل مراکزی که توزیع کننده این قطعات بودن اطلاعات جمع آوری میکردن و ایشون حساس میشه میاد با همکارای ما در سازمان حفاظت اطلاعات در میون میذاره و همکارا چون اطلاعات دیگری هم داشتن فهمت. که یک علائمی رو از قبل به دست آورده بودن اینها رو تقاطع اطلاعاتی میدن با تقاطع اطلاعاتی و با کمک ایشون بقیه شبکه کم کم تحت شناسایی قرار میگیره منتها به گونه ای که به هیچ وجه موساد و سرویس رژیم صهیونیستی متوجه این اشرافیت اطلاعاتی ایران نشد.
Israeli spy agency the Mossad has been at the heart of anti-Iran plots for decades. Simply put, it's targeted Iran in order to stop advancements in a variety of sectors, but apparently what's been of interest is Iran's nuclear program and defense industry. This includes targeting scientists and nuclear facilities.
Under the false pretext of preventing Iran from obtaining nuclear weapons, Mossad has been carrying out a campaign of sabotage and cyber attacks on Iran's civilian nuclear program for quite some time. One of the notorious ones was the Stuxnet virus. In April 2011, Iranian government official Ghulam Reza Jalali stated that an investigation had concluded that both the United States and Israel were behind the Stuxnet attack. Mossad has also methodically assassinated and murdered Iranian nuclear scientists, from magnetic bombs attached to the side of their cars, to the use of poison, and allegedly the use of a killer robot remotely used as an assassin. Additionally, Israel has also targeted Iran's nuclear facilities. Israel's targeting of Iran's defense industry, in particular its drones and missile program, does make sense from Israel's point of view. Iran has made extraordinary advancements in these two fields and military hardware overall. But all of these destructive actions, which Israel has not claimed responsibility for, has not been able to stop Iran's advancement. From Israel's perspective, it makes strategic sense, though only a temporary fix. There's an Iranian saying that says, "Don't play with the lion's tail." Iran may have thwarted these acts of sabotage, but for how long will its patience last when it comes to Israel?
Hundreds of people in Belgrade have staged a rally against the government of Serbian President Aleksandar Vučić. Protesters chanted for the removal of Vučić, and they marched to the city and assembled in front of parliament. They condemned violence and alleged political corruption. Protest organizers also demand dismissal of several officials. Protests in Belgrade and throughout Serbia began after two deadly mass shootings in the country in May and carried on throughout the summer. And that's it for your latest, everyone. Thank you for joining us here on World News.
The bustle of life. The sound of living. Only sound will endure.
Hello.
IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
BRICS represents the growing aspiration for a more balanced global order. While this threatens imperialist domination, it also injects positive energy and new confidence into the world. Regarding this issue, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Global Times noted, within days of each other, two very different meetings of world significance were held. These meetings sharply framed the choices. Is the way forward cooperation, sustainable development and trade, or is the only option confrontation and military escalation? What kind of future do these two meetings represent? It deserves to be analyzed and compared. At the Camp David military base outside of Washington, D.C. on August 18th, U.S. President Joe Biden framed an aggressive military alliance with South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol and Japanese Prime Minister Fumio Kishida dutifully attending. This trilateral security agreement of the U.S., South Korea, and Japan is directly aimed at China and North Korea. The military bloc is understood as concretizing a new Cold War against China. Whether the recent agreement holds together or not, the Camp David meeting is a further step in Washington's strategy of inserting tensions, instability, and continuing provocations in the region in an attempt to block China's development and its growing regional trade with its neighbors. Washington is attempting to mask the economic decline of the U.S. by asserting its military dominance in the Pacific. In sharp contrast, the 15th BRICS Summit, held under the theme BRICS and Africa, Partnership for Mutually Accelerated Growth, Sustainable Development, and Inclusive Multilateralism, opened 4 days later, from August 22nd to 24th, in Johannesburg, South Africa. This summit focused on building an open world economy that supports trade and promotes cooperation. Concrete plans for African development was a recurring theme. BRICS stands for Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa. These 5 countries, with a total population of 3 billion, or 40% of the world's people, have widely different political and economic systems. However, they are all developing countries and were once colonies or neo-colonies. At the conclusion of the gathering, South African President Cyril Ramaphosa announced that 6 more countries were admitted to BRICS, including Iran, Argentina, Egypt, Ethiopia, Saudi Arabia, and the UAE. At the BRICS meeting, Chinese President Xi Jinping expressed China's willingness to deepen solidarity and cooperation with other emerging markets and developing countries to push for a more just and equitable world order. President Xi's speech declared, "Emerging countries are becoming more and more relevant in the international arena." This summit will very much contribute to the shaping of a new global economic and political order. It will help change the current situation when it comes to international relations. The overwhelming U.S. military presence in Japan and South Korea since 1945 exerts extreme political pressure. This constant pressure is felt in every country occupied by U.S. troops and military bases. There are still 53,700 U.S. troops in Japan on 120 military bases, more bases than in any other country. Some 26,400 U.S. troops are stationed on 73 bases in South Korea, including Camp Humphreys, the largest overseas U.S. military base. This new Camp David security agreement is a result of Washington's revival and upgrading of the Quad, which holds joint military exercises that openly target China. Another military alliance, the AUKUS Trilateral Security Pact, among the US, Australia, and the UK, has provided cover for US naval and air training missions in the region. Under that pact, the US and the UK will assist Australia in acquiring nuclear-powered submarines. China is a major trading partner of more than 120 countries and regions, including Japan, South Korea, the Philippines, and Australia. U.S. corporate interests are consumed with the task of how to reverse this economic reality and contain China in the Asia-Pacific region and globally. The biggest and most immediate impact of this military offensive will be felt on the global environment, increasing insecurity. Rather than focusing on resources and the vast scientific and technical know-how, on the escalating climate crisis, U.S. corporations focus on quick profits from war. U.S. politicians feel the pressure to vote for even more increases in military allocations. According to the National Priorities Project, the full military budget of the U.S. is approximately $900 billion, more than the next 10 countries combined and 40% of the world total. While the security pact devised at Camp David won't reverse the declining economic power of the U.S., it will intensify global insecurity. The BRICS group embraces more equitable trade and development, which is a challenge to U.S. sanctions imposed on nearly 40 countries. The growing ability of countries to use their own currencies in direct trade is a threat to the power of the almighty dollar. The BRICS economies have overtaken the G7's global GDP. The atmosphere of solidarity and cooperation, exemplified by the BRICS cooperation mechanism, is helping to propel development across the African continent. Over 40 countries have expressed a desire to become a member, including those in the West Asia region, Latin America, and Africa. Tasnim News Agency noted the expanding membership of the BRICS is signaling a desire to seek an alternative to the prevailing international order after a failure of U.S. economic leadership. The U.S. turned away from economic leadership in line with the policy of former President Donald Trump, a course that was then affirmed by incumbent President Joe Biden, an article in Bloomberg said. It said the International Monetary Fund, IMF, and the World Bank are increasingly rudderless and don't meet the interest of BRICS members. Russian President Vladimir Putin and Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi noted when they spoke by phone on August 28 that BRICS expansion would undoubtedly help bolster the group's influence in international affairs, the Kremlin said and TASS reported. The BRICS held a summit in Johannesburg from August 22nd to 24th. Summit participants agreed that Iran, Argentina, Egypt, Ethiopia, Saudi Arabia, and the UAE would join the group on January 1st, 2024. Another international group, the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, announced in July that Iran was joining as its ninth member.
IRIB English Radio presents
Viewpoints.
The presence of different scholars.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio Call of Islam page. We welcome to another episode of the program Viewpoints. I'm Ata, the host of this program. Sayyid Mahdi and Sheikh Rouhani are the guest speakers for today's discussion. Sayyid Mahdi, assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum salam, rahmatullah. It's nice to be here.
And Sheikh Rouhani, assalamu alaikum.
Assalamu alaikum, rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Okay, for today's discussion, we want to talk about Arba'in Walk and how to change this walk to a spiritual journey. As we are producing this program, so many people have started their journey towards the city of Karbala in order to be ready for the day of Arba'in. Of course, the day of Arba'in is one day, that is 40 days after the martyrdom of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, but people all across the world, especially in Iraq and Iran, from, for example, Afghanistan, Turkey, and the countries around Iraq, you know, start their journey maybe 1 week or 2 weeks sooner on feet in order to get to the city of Karbala. This procession and this walk has been changed into an iconic symbol of the Shiism all across the world, And year after year, so many people are joining this walk and procession towards the city of Karbala. So, Sayyid Mahdi, let's start with you, brother, how we should prepare ourselves for Arba'een walk and how to change it into a spiritual journey.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. I think the Arba'een walk, of course, as you said, occurring on the 20th of Safar, is considered to be the world's largest annual public gathering. The world's, right? Yes. So you have an estimated 25 plus million individuals who come from all across the world. So you have a lot of these pilgrims from the United States, from Europe, and different parts of the world. And then you even have some, you know, sometimes it's said that this is just a Shia gathering, but you have a lot of brothers from the Ahlul Sunnah who come to this pilgrimage. Really? You have a lot of, they call them Ismailis or Bohra, which are, you know, they believe in six imams, not all 12 imams. So you have a non-Muslims who come from across the world
Christians,
as well.
Yes,
so yes. Christians and Jews, even Hindus. So it's a very interesting gathering. And I think the one thing that you find in common is this connection to spirituality, right? And this is something that and anybody who wants to go on the Arba'een walk, they should really consider their niyyah and their intention to gain nearness to the Almighty Allah. Don't consider it as a vacation or, you know, as a tourist trip and going sightseeing, and because that won't bring about the spiritual and psychological reformation that needs to be done, right? Is this idea that this pilgrimage that is being taken is in order for us to be able to gain nearness to the Almighty Allah and to be able to spiritually progress in yes. our lives, not just in Arba'een before and during the trip, but yes. also after the trip when we come back to our homes.
Usually they call the kind of spiritual wayfaring or Sayru Suluk Manavi, okay?
Right.
You know, so many people have learned lessons from spiritual training. They say in order, for example, to reform yourself, you have to leave the place you live in, for example, in the city that you have, in the house that you have, with all the facilities that you have, leave it and go toward a holy destination, now namely Karbala. And in this way, station by station, mawkab by mawkab, amud by amud, column by column, you can learn so many lessons, okay? So it is the trip of contemplation, it is a trip of as we said, the spiritual wayfaring and journey. Sheikh Rouhani, is it so?
I think one of the great lessons that we can learn from this spiritual journey and walking is the lesson of ikhlas, sincerity. Why? Because Abu Abdullah al-Husayn alayhi salatu wassalam, very sincerely, with the highest level of sincerity, he sacrificed each and everything he had for the sake of Almighty Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and his life to the way of Almighty Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in the presence of thousands of soldiers of the enemy.
Yes.
As he was beheaded in the presence of his children, his family, his enemy. And with this, it was, I think, the highest level of sacrifice, sincerity, honesty, what you can do in the presence of God is this: to be beheaded in the presence of your household, your children, and your enemy in the public, as Imam Al-Asr Arwahuna Fida addresses saying that Assalamu ala al-manhuri fil wara. So it is the highest level of, I think, sincerity that we can see in the history. I think we do not have any other example in the history, in the whole history. This way that someone sacrifice each and everything, his life, for the sake of Almighty Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. I think out of this sincerity of Abu Abdullah al-Husayn alayhi salatu wassalam, nowadays we see the manifestation of this sincerity in the presence of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in the Arba'een procession and walk. As you rightly mentioned, in each and every of those tents or
mawkib stations,
in each one of them you can see the sincerity, the ikhlas of mu'min. Yeah, in each one of them.
Yes.
Sometimes, all of us have seen this.
Yes, yes.
That sometimes we see some old ladies, old men and women, they have nothing except for a cup of tea.
Yes.
They bring this cup of tea by themselves and serve you. They have nothing else.
Yes.
It is said that sometimes there are some people, they have nothing. They sometimes try to, what can I say, to... Let the people to make use of their shadow.
Yes, to be an umbrella.
To be an umbrella, exactly.
Yes,
it is
shadow.
Very... Look, these people, they...
Yeah, I've seen so many people on this way, you know, acting as an umbrella
as an
to
umbrella,
make shadow.
Yeah, by their body.
By the body, yes.
It's so hot. The weather is so hot in those deserts, yeah?
For the people, yes.
But they stand and let the people make use of their shadow.
Just inviting the hospitability of the Iraqis.
Exactly.
Especially in the villages, you know, and they come from the villages on the main road, take your hand to their houses, to invite you to their houses, you know, they welcome you warmly. Yeah. I've heard one of them, for example, saying that during the year, I spend less to gather money for such a week, okay, so that I can spend it for the Zovar of the
Zandosan. The question is that, can you find any sort of ikhlas into this level, particularly nowadays in the modern world? Can you find any example? I don't think so. I'm 100% sure that there is no such a sincerity, such a ikhlas. Why we see this manifestation of ikhlas? Is it a kind of, let's say, political decisions made by the government? Sometimes people say blame it on Islamic Republic of Iran, on Iraqi government, that they make this. No, man. No government can provoke or motivate the people to this extent to make himself an umbrella. You know? What government can do that? No government can do that. No power can do that.
Yes.
It is the divine. It is the manifestation of divinely ikhlas.
Yes.
It is.
Yes.
Because of what? Because the body of Abu Abdullah al-Husayn alayhi salatu wasalam remained in the desert of Karbala, you know, without any kafan.
Yes.
Without any ghusl. So because of that body that remained in the desert, that's why nowadays we see the people make themselves umbrella for the zawar of that body, for the zawar of Abu Abdullah al-Husayn alayhi salam. It is a divine manifestation of ikhlas, of ibadah.
Yes.
It is the pure ibadah, because ibadah, the pure ibadah is the one which is with highest level of ikhlas.
Very good.
Yeah.
Very good.
That's why this kind of things that you see, it is ibadah.
How a waq can be changed to ibadah? This is nice.
It is ibadah. It is worshipping Almighty Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in the purest and the most perfect possible way. For the human being.
That's right.
That you can never find any other example in the whole history, I think.
That's
throughout
right.
the history of the world.
Yes, no.
You cannot find
it. And this is not something new. This action has been done during the history of Islam. But during some governments, it was banned. It was boycotted. It was, you know, restricted by the people. Still, the people were doing it from the hidden ways and the hidden roads towards the city of Karbala. Nowadays, and mashallah, you know, the people are doing it openly, and it's good. So, ikhlas is one of the things that we can learn. What about the other things, Sayyid Mehdi, that we can learn from this trip?
Right, so there's really a lot of things that you can learn on this trip. For people who haven't gone, really, we here encourage everybody to go, you know, if they have the means to. It's really amazing. So you see women, children, you see old people, young people, families. You know, they have strollers with their small children. You even see people who are handicapped or disabled, you know, they might not have legs. They're on a wheelchair. It's really something that you
weird, something weird.
Well, it's amazing. I think this divine manifestation that Sheikh Rouhani talked about is a divine manifestation of a lot of very different aspects, you know, so sincerity. Of course, this idea of being able to live with one another despite your ethnic differences, your national background, the different languages. Some of the scholars that we've listened to, they talk about how this is a very small example of the society in the age of the Imam of the time, Imam al-Mahdi, may Allah hasten his reappearance, where you see justice, you see equity, you see compassion, you see mercy, and you see people giving whatever they have for the sake of Allah on, you know, a level of millions. Mm-hmm. So like we were just talking about, somebody can only offer a shadow, but they are offering a shadow, right? Somebody can offer food, they are offering. So this idea of sacrifice, this idea of offering, of putting what you have for the sake of Allah and for the sake of fellow humanity, right? So this is, I think, another lesson, an important lesson, is this idea of self-sacrifice, of offering what you have for Islam, for the Almighty Allah.
And the people all across the world, as you said, have dedicated their donations, Nuzura, to this way, to this past. As I said, they spend money and they spend wealth, we can say properties, on this way. With the simplest things possible, for example, sewing or brushing the shoes, or I don't know, repairing the shoes, for example, on the way. I've seen so many people, for example, repairing the luggages of the people, yeah, or the trolleys of the children, you know, over there.
I want to add here, and they're all complete strangers to one another. It's not like, yes, you know, these are from your neighborhood, or, you know, they don't know each other. And that's what mm-hmm. makes it even more amazing, is this is a complete stranger who has come from another country. And yeah, sometimes they don't even speak the same language. They don't even know, you know, uh-huh. but he's sitting there brushing this guy's shoes, as you said, or giving food, or being a shadow. All for what? For the sake of the Almighty Allah, and of course for the sake of Imam yeah. Hussein alayhi salam.
And Imam al-Hussein is the symbolic language now between the two, you know, mm-hmm. between all the people. As you said, the affection that is present over there. So in this way, we can get closer to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, isn't it? I mean, the final goal is finding proximity to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala through the name of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. Even some people do not reach Karbala because it is very much crowded, okay? Yeah, of course, yeah. But it's still being on this way have helped them. This is when we can say reaching the destination is important, but reaching the way is also very important in comparison to the destination, Sheikh, isn't it?
Yeah, of course. Why not? You know, as it was rightly mentioned by our brother Sayyid Mahdi, okay?
Yes.
That no one asks about your nationality mm-hmm. there, you know? There's no meaning for nationality.
Race, nationality,
yeah, race,
language.
Nationality, language, culture.
Yes.
Even there are sometimes non-Muslims. No one asks that, are you Muslim or not Muslim? Are you Shia or not Shia? You know, the people who serve, they never ask. They never ask. There are lots of videos that are published by some of the tourists. They yeah. sometimes attend this gathering to see what happened. They are non-Muslims. They are treated, they are behaved exactly like other Shias and Muslims without any kind of differences.
Yes.
Sometimes there are some of the Salafis and Wahhabis, they also take part. And they publish their videos from Africa. You see the videos are available on internet.
Yes.
They say that from Algeria, from Tunisia, from many other countries. They say that they serve us like their brothers,
mm-hmm.
like their sisters, like their children.
Yes.
You know, like their father and mother.
Yes.
This way they respect us. And, you know, this is the pure, let's say, Islamic nation, Islamic society, Islamic, let's say, social order. You know, there's no class, no classification, let's say, no class system, no
yes.
racism, no, nothing is... Mm-hmm. is
no discrimination.
Yeah, no discrimination. It is more than justice. You know, justice
yes,
is like kind of equity.
Yes.
But they serve the people with, what we can say, with that level of generosity that
yes.
it is really strange. That is why I think, inshallah, with the presence of the Holy Imam, Al-Mahdi, ajalallahu ta'ala, farajuhu sharif.
Inshallah.
We hope that in that day we would have this kind of society.
Yes.
Of course, the first pure Islamic society will be established in the city of Kufa,
mm-hmm.
in the presence of the Imam alayhi salatu wasalam. As we see nowadays, this walk starts from Najaf and Kufa.
Yes, yes.
And mostly the people of Kufa and Najaf gather and start this walking.
That's right.
And of course, I think...
And the spirit, course, and keeping the spirit alive after the walk is finished, you know, is also important in our societies.
Of course,
that's right. Okay, that's right. This is Hussein, and the name of Hussein, which is, I think, the saving key to the so many of problems of the today's world, not only the Muslims, but today's world. That's why non-Muslims are fascinated, you know.
According to the narrations to Ahadith, when Imam Al-Asr Rahun al-Fadar reappears in the holy city of Mecca, he introduces himself with Imam Al-Husayn.
That's right.
The first sentence that he starts, Inna Jaddi Al-Husayn Qataluhu Atshana. This is the sentence that he will say while standing in front of the Holy Kaaba, according to the narrations.
Okay.
It shows that Imam Hussein becomes such a popular at that time to the whole world that all the people from across the globe, they know Imam Hussein. When he mentioned the name of Imam Hussein, they know.
That's right.
Yeah,
good
because
point.
Of this, yeah, because of this, he introduces himself by his Jad Abu Abdullah al-Hussein. This is very interesting. It is mentioned in the Riwayat, yes.
Thank you very much, Sheikh Rouhani and Sayyid Mahdi, for a nice elaboration. How should we prepare ourselves for Arba'in Walk and how to change this walk to a spiritual journey? Those who are on the way to the city of Karbala on Arba'in Walk and Arba'in Procession, do not forget us in your spiritual wavering, your supplications and du'as on this way. And know that this would be the trip of sincerity towards Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala through the path of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. Inshallah, Allah will give us a chance to also attend this walk every year and to be present on this walk toward the city of Karbala, inshallah. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of the program Viewpoints. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.ir, Call of Islam page. The another episode, God bless you all, fi amal.
Allahu akbar, jibitni al-Karbala. خويا يا حسين دشوف العائلة الله أكبر جبتني الكربلاء خويا يا حسين دشوف العائلة.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, for listening to this episode of Viewpoints. Please don't forget to log on to our website at parstoday.ir. Until next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Limelight. Britain is facing a homelessness crisis, with a number of people living in temporary accommodation in England at a 25-year high. The homelessness crisis in the United Kingdom comes on the heels of a mortgage crisis, which has been brewing for some time. We take a look at some of the world media and press's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Independent has covered this story and tells us more. Figures show the record number of British families are being forced to live in temporary accommodation, with experts blaming a shameful lack of social housing. A special investigation by The Independent has revealed that a majority of local authorities had failed to build a single council house last year, as waiting lists continued to soar. Now, official figures show almost 105,000 households were in temporary accommodation at the end of March of this year, a 25-year high. This included more than 131,000 children, the highest level since records for that measure began in 2004. Campaigners slammed the government for failing to support the building of affordable homes and warned the time for empty words on building social homes had long passed. Matt Downey, chief executive of Crisis, said families were trapped in temporary accommodation due to the crippling cost of years of no investment in housing benefit and a shameful lack of social house building. Matt Downey added, "Not only do people not have the stability and security of a home, but they're often left to cope in just one room, with no facilities to cook meals or do washing," noting that households across the country desperately need more social homes. Paula Barker, the Shadow Homelessness Minister, said the figures were a shameful indictment of the British government's record, which have devastating consequences for thousands of families and children. Of the 104,510 households in temporary accommodation by the end of March, a high since records began in 1998, 64,940 were households with children. Both of these figures are up by about 10% on the same period last year. Temporary accommodation is offered to homeless households who are waiting for their application for help to be processed and to be offered a settled home. The latest statistics come just a day after Britain's Minister for Levelling Up, Housing and Communities and Minister for Intergovernmental Relations, Michael Gove, claimed the government would slash red tape to address the housing crisis and allow shops, takeaways and betting shops to be turned into living spaces. The housing minister also pledged to spark intensive building in cities and change planning laws to allow more home extensions. Michael Gove's announcements were mocked in the House of Lords by Labour's Baroness Taylor, who stated, "With over a million people on social housing waiting lists and 7,000 social rented homes built last year, does the minister really think a few flats built over chip shops is going to solve the problem?" There is a huge need for affordable housing, and local authorities, who were traditionally big builders of social housing, have decreased the number of homes they built in recent decades. Analysis of government data by The Independent found that in each of the last five financial years, two-thirds of councils failed to build a single home themselves. In 2021-2022, 207 out of 307 councils that provided data to the government had not built a home in that period. A snap survey of district and borough councils in England carried out by The Independent also found that just over half of local authorities did not build a single home in the whole of 2022. As the latest figures were released, Polly Neat, chief executive at homeless charity Shelter, said, "The time for empty words on building social homes and overdue promises on ending no-fault evictions has long passed." Polly Neat added, "To end homelessness for good, we need genuinely affordable homes." Michael Gove agrees social homes are essential to solving the housing emergency, so it's time for his government to get on and build them. Riverside, an organisation which describes itself as the largest provider of accommodation for people affected by homelessness, described the figures as very worrying. The figures released by the Department for Levelling Up, Housing and Communities also show nearly 80,000 households face homelessness in England between January and March of this year, the highest figure since 2018. The charity Shelter said a major contributing factor to rising homelessness was the instability of private renting, with the loss of a tenancy now the leading cause. The British newspaper The Guardian has also reported on the same story. In the last year, 24,060 UK households were threatened with homelessness as a result of a Section 21 no-fault eviction, which allows landlords to repossess their properties without having to establish fault on the part of the tenant. This is up 21% compared to the previous 12 months. Meanwhile, rent prices hit a new record in the past weeks, with property website Rightmove recording that the average rent outside London had risen to £1,231 per month. The Salvation Army warned that unless the freeze on housing benefit is lifted, more families would lose their homes because of rent rises. Nick Redmore, the charity's director of homelessness services, said, "Today's figures show more people than ever are losing the battle to keep a roof over their heads. Unless housing benefits are urgently raised to cover the cost of rent, the homelessness crisis will only worsen." Between January and March of this year, 1,760 households were made homeless due to rent arrears, compared with 1,390 in the same period a year earlier. Households needing help from local authorities because they were homeless or threatened with homelessness by March this year rose 5.7% on the same period last year to 83,240. Of the 41,950 households assessed as homeless and therefore owed a relief duty help to secure settled accommodation by their local authority between January and March of this year, 11,250 were households with children, up 12.1% from the same quarter last year. Of the households in temporary accommodation in the first quarter of this year, 13,780 were living in bed and breakfast. This is up by more than a third, or 37%, from the same time last year. The number of households who were sleeping rough when they approached their local authority for help was up by almost a fifth, or 18%, from the first quarter of last year to 3,770 households. The homelessness crisis in England comes on the heels of a mortgage crisis which has been brewing for some time. The Bank of England hiked interest rates by 50 basis points to 5% back in June. The move has affected millions of homeowners in Britain, as the interest rates on many mortgages are directly linked to the central bank's base rate. Tenants have seen their rent increase as buy-to-let landlords pass on higher mortgage repayments. Estimates suggest that the Bank of England interest rate hike would see 1.2 million British households run out of savings by the end of the year due to higher mortgage payments. Higher borrowing costs are not just affecting households with mortgages and other loans, but forcing companies to tread more carefully in their management of costs in a tougher economy. The mortgage crisis comes against the backdrop of slowdown in Britain's economy.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.